Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to today's public event lecture. I'm Steve Machen. I'm a professor in the economics department here at LSE, and I'm a director of the Centre for Economic Performance, also at LSE. I'm really pleased to be here to welcome our speaker, Jeff Gogger, and our audience here today, and our online audience, to be talking the Old Theatre. I'm delighted to have Jeff come and give this public lecture. We're particularly delighted because he's here visiting us in the Economics Department and CEP as a visiting professor. He's also got a continuing relationship with us in terms of doing doing research and policy-related work at the Centre for Economic Performance. Jeff Gogger is the Irving Harris Professor in Urban Policy at the Harris School, the University of Chicago, Harris School of Public Policy at the University of Chicago. He's written extensively many scholarly articles focusing on a number of pertinent issues, often surrounding kind of low-income populations, about crime, about immigration, about education, about issues to do with racial inequalities, a lot of issues to do with social problems, often in the US, but not exclusively so. In terms of his work, he's an applied economist, an applied microeconomist, one of the trailblazers actually in using administrative data amongst economists back in the 1990s, I think. His amazing data on matching up arrest data with individuals' labour market outcomes, wages and employment, and looking for scarring effects from having a criminal history on wages and employment. Extremely pathbreaking in the sense of using the data, but also the methods that were used in the paper. He's a leading authority, I think it's not unfair to say, on social insurance programs and on US welfare reform and policies. Again, about relatively low-income populations in the United States. So what he's going to talk to us about today is one of his areas of research in the economics of crime, and he's particularly going to look at domestic abuse, a very, very important subject that sort of economists have come a little bit late in the day to studying. Many other social science disciplines were looking at some of these questions earlier. Obviously highly important. According to some estimates, domestic abuse affects roughly one-third of women at some point during their lives worldwide, and obviously carries serious, both short-run and potentially long-run consequences for them as victims, but also, more broadly, maybe spillovers onto children, other family members and so on, and for society in terms of in society at large, in terms of very substantive economic and social costs. So Jeff's going to talk in particular about some studies that he's been doing in Britain, looking at the risk assessment process that's been used over the last 15 years or so, beginning I think in 2009, whereby police try to identify victims who are potentially at high risk of repeat abuse, and thinking about the way that connects with welfare services, particularly protective services, as well. So this is going to be another example of using large-scale data, big data, big administrative data, looking at about 150,000 cases of intimate partner violence, and looking at various questions to do with analysing those data. you know, I don't want to preempt the talk before Jeff gets up, but he's going to look at some very important questions about how good or bad is this risk assessment process about predicting future serious incidents. Does it work to do that? Does it interact well with police officers' decision-making processes as they do it, and so on? So I think it's going to be, you know, talking about this work and thinking also about what a constructive path forward might be, with implications for both the police and for policymakers in terms of that, and how we might think about the design, implementation, and use of particular risk assessment tools in the context of domestic abuse cases. Okay. So we're going to have Jeff in a minute. A few kind of room-keeping exercises. So for anybody who's on social media, I think we have an online audience out there as well. That's one thing. So anybody who's on, I always say Twitter, but it's X, isn't it, these days? So the hashtag hashtag for the event is hashtag, and in capitals, LSEE, and then the last part of events, VENTS. So LSE events. The event's going to be recorded, and as long as the recording goes well, it'll be a podcast, subject to being no technical difficulties as we kind of go through. So in terms of actual logistics, Jeff is going to talk for around about 45 minutes, I think. Only really if there's any questions, clarification questions as we go through that. Then after that, we'll have an opportunity for the audience and the online audience to put forward questions in a Q&A session. I'll let you know when that starts, and we'll have a roving mic that you can speak into and ask various questions. So that's enough of that for now, I think. I'm delighted to hand over to Jeff. We're delighted to have him here to come and give this this lecture on assessing risk assessment in cases of domestic abuse.
Okay, so thank you very much for the kind introduction. Thank you to CEP and to Economics for having me, I guess LSE more generally. What I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about a whole agenda of work that I've been involved in. Where do I point? There we go. Okay, sorry. So what I'm going to do is tonight I'm going to talk about an agenda of work involving risk assessment and domestic abuse that I've been working on for the last 5 or so years. And this work has all been done with a number of collaborators, most of whom are based here at LSE. And so it's I'm really happy to be giving this talk here, and it's really great to actually be here for the full year and be able to talk to my collaborators in person on a regular basis. And so anyway, over the course of the talk, I hope to address three questions here: whether the risk assessment system protects, whether it predicts, and then ask some questions about how officers make decisions. So to give some background to start with, domestic abuse is both pervasive and consequential. So as Steve indicated, there are a number of surveys that suggest that roughly 1 in 3 women worldwide are going to experience domestic abuse at some point in their lives. There is a very large academic literature that shows that it has serious consequences for victims as well as their children. And then in a completely different vein, in England, domestic abuse accounts for nearly 10% of all calls to police. Now, in England and Wales, when police respond to a domestic abuse call, one of their most important tasks is to predict whether the victim faces a high risk of serious recidivism. And so I want to talk about that for a minute. So since 2009, English police nationwide have used a protocol called DASH, which consists of 3 parts. So the first part is a questionnaire. The responding officer administers at the scene of the incident a 27-item survey to the victim, asking questions about circumstances of the current incident, signs of coercive control, and past behavior of the perpetrator. Based on those questions and the officer's professional judgment, the officer then classifies the risk facing the victim as either standard, medium, or high. And what high risk means is that there are identifiable indicators of risk of serious harm The potential event could happen at any time, and the impact would be serious. And the import of this high-risk designation is that it results in referral. It results in a referral to a multi-agency risk assessment conference for protective services. So if victims are designated as high risk, they have the opportunity to get the protective services from the MARAC, and otherwise they don't. So it's potentially consequential. Okay, now, so anyway, so that's the basic system. And my collaborators and I have asked, as I said, these three questions about this risk assessment system. So one is whether it protects, which is to say, does a high risk classification actually reduce serious repeat harm? The second is, does it predict? And here we ask how accurate officers' predictions are as to who's at high risk. And then third, and most recently, we're asking questions about how officers make their decisions, what drives their predictions, and where they go wrong. So our data come from Greater Manchester Police, and GMP has been an excellent research partner in this enterprise. From their IT system, we have assembled 154,000 incidents of domestic abuse between intimate partners. And what we have here are linked incident reports, the dash forms, and the responses to the questions, victim and perpetrator records, as well as criminal and domestic abuse histories. So we also use these data to construct our key outcome variable, the thing that we spend most of our time analyzing, which we call serious recidivism. And so serious recidivism, I'll tell you what it is and then why we chose this. So serious recidivism takes place if there is any domestic abuse call involving either violence with injury or sexual assault within 12 months of the initial incident. And serious recidivism basically is our attempt to square the notion of serious harm that the DASH is attempting to predict and prevent with the definitions of the various criminal codes that are available to us in the English criminal justice system. Okay, and we square that with this definition of serious recidivism. And just to give you a couple numbers that I'll be referring back to, the baseline rate of serious recidivism in our sample is 13%, whereas the share of cases that are classified as high risk is 9%. Okay, so part one, the first question we asked here is, does it protect? Does the risk assessment process reduce serious recidivism? Now, so you need to know a little bit more about what happens when police attend a domestic abuse incident. So one thing they do, we've already discussed, they assess risk using the DASH process with the goal of providing services, protective services to victims who are deemed to be at high risk. But at the same time, they carry out a criminal investigation. We can think of this as sort of the conventional law enforcement approach to a call for service. And so here the questions are different. They're backward looking rather than forward looking. But the first question that officers are supposed to address is whether a crime occurred. If a crime occurred, the next question is there enough evidence to levy charges? And if so, then the perpetrator may be arrested, detained, or deterred. And so the question that we ask in this study is whether these two interventions, either alone or together, actually reduce the chance of serious repeat recidivism. Now, this raises what economists call an identification challenge, which stems from something called selection bias. And put simply, what that means is that cases that lead to charges are different from cases that don't. And likewise, cases that are classified as high risk are different from those that aren't. They're different in ways other than just involving the fact that some are graded as high risk and some aren't. So anyway, what this means is we can't simply compare outcomes of the two groups, those that are classified as high risk and those that are classified as lower risk. So instead, what we have to do is use some sort of method that's going to equalize as many of the differences as possible between these two groups to allow us to isolate the effects of charges on the one hand and the high risk designation on the other. And so the methods that we use in this study are a combination of weighting methods and causal forests. And we use these to estimate treatment effects, that is, the effects of these interventions, conditioning on a rich set of characteristics. What are the characteristics? They're precisely the DASH responses, the criminal histories, domestic abuse histories, characteristics of the participants, and incident circumstances that are available from GMP's database. And so under certain conditions, this approach is going to let us estimate the causal effect of both of these interventions on serious recidivism. Now, I'm going to jump straight to the results. There are two main results from this study. One's good news, one's bad news. So the good news is that criminal charges reduce serious recidivism by 5 percentage points. And that's actually, in relative terms, that's a pretty big effect because the baseline recidivism rate is 13%. So in relative terms, that's a 40% reduction. That's pretty large. That's the good news. The bad news is that the DASH risk assessment process has an essentially inconsequential effect. It doesn't provide meaningful protection. So we find that the effects that we estimate are very small and not significant, statistically significantly different from zero. So we conclude that on the one hand, charging perpetrators works. So the criminal justice system's traditional tool, which is prosecuting those suspects when the evidence permits, has a meaningful protective effect. But on the other hand, the risk assessment process does not. So despite the substantial infrastructure that has grown up over the years surrounding the DASH MARAC procedure, our evidence says the process doesn't deliver protection. Now, so that immediately raises the question, so why does the risk assessment protocol fail? And you can think of two reasons. One is that the services aren't effective. And that's a really important question. It's one we'll never be able to address. And the reason is we don't observe specific services that are provided to particular victims because these services are provided by charities. And those charities are guard their data very closely for security reasons. So that's not a question that we can deal with. We can deal with another question, though, with another thing that might explain why the risk assessment doesn't do any more than it does. And that's the issue of poor predictions. And the problem here is that if officers' predictions are poor, then lower risk victims may receive services while higher risk victims do not, and such that we don't find any effect on average. And so this motivates the question in the next study, which is how well do officers predict risk? Okay, so in here what we're interested in is the accuracy of officers' risk assessments. Now, before we do this, there's a complication that we have to solve. And this is something, there's something called censoring, which we can think of as a data problem in a way. And what happens, it arises because when an officer classifies a victim as high risk, then protective services are deployed. And so this may turn what would have been a true positive into a false positive. And if we don't do anything about it, that's going to bias our assessment of the accuracy of officers' predictions. And I'm hoping this little schematic helps. So let's see if it does. So the idea is this. So the officer predicts high risk. Protective services are deployed. As a result of those services, the victim stays safe, which means we don't observe recidivism. So to us, this looks like a false positive. But at the same time, the officer may have been right. Because in the absence of the protective services, we may have observed a case of recidivism, in which case we would have seen a true positive. Okay, and so it turns out that what's important to accurately assess the adequacy of officers' predictions here is to know, or in our case, impute, what would have happened in the absence of the protective services. And so what we do here is we develop a method based on the causal force that we used before to impute latent recidivism, that is, that which would have happened absent the intervention. And this is going, again, under certain conditions, this is going to let us sort of accurately assess how well officers predict. Okay, now, how do we measure predictive accuracy? We are going to use concepts from signal detection theory. And one of the basic tools from signal detection theory is a confusion matrix. And so what's that? That just cross-classifies the officer's prediction, either high risk or not high risk, against the actual outcome, serious recidivism or no recidivism. Now, one of four things can happen. So the officer can predict high risk, and we can observe serious recidivism, in which case that's a true positive. The officer can predict not at high risk, standard or medium risk, and we don't observe recidivism, in which case we have a true negative. There are also two types of errors. And so one type of error is a false positive. That happens when the officer predicts high risk but no recidivism occurs. And then there's a false negative, and that's when the officer predicts either standard or medium risk, but we observe serious recidivism. So we're going to convert false positives and false negatives to rates, so the false positive rate and the false negative rate, and we're going to use those to construct a measure of the adequacy of officers' predictions. So what does that look like? So we have a false positive rate of 8.6%, which doesn't sound too bad. What sounds quite a bit worse is the false negative rate. So you see the false negative rate here is 88.6%. Now, I'm going to come back to that. But in the meantime, we're going to take these two rates and use that to construct something with the sort of mysterious sounding name of the area under the curve. We don't have to get into a lot of details because there's one really important thing about the area under the curve, and that is if that thing is equal to 1, that means predictions are perfect. If it's equal to 0.5, it means that the predictions are no better than random guessing. So what do we see in our sample? We get an AUC of 0.514, so 50, let's just call it 0.514. And so what does that mean? It means that officers' predictions are just a little bit better than a coin flip. Okay, now, let's come back and talk more explicitly about the false negative rate all by itself. What does a false negative rate of 88.6% mean? It means that officers miss nearly 9 out of 10 recidivists. Another way to say this is they only identify 1 out of 10 victims who will suffer a case of serious recidivism in the future. Okay, so in other words, 9/10 of those victims are, you know, by extension, not being offered services to protect them, to help keep them safe. Okay, so a high false negative rate is a real problem. Now, oh, and I should say, so I told you all about censoring. What I just showed you is based on the raw data, no adjustments. The adjustment for censoring, so this is logically necessary, but empirically not so consequential. When we adjust for the censoring using our imputation method, the AUC improves to 0.52, which means that officers are slightly better than the raw data suggest, but the predictions are still far from adequate. Turns out you can go a little deeper on this, and you can actually compute AUCs for individual police officers, at least for those officers who have enough incidents in the sample. And when we do this, what we find is that about 10% of those officers actually have an AUC less than 0.5, which means, quite literally, they would do better by flipping a coin. Okay, so there's sort of two points here. One is, adjusting for censoring doesn't change the picture. DASH just isn't doing a good job of identifying who's at high risk. Okay, now, so one possibility here is, well, obviously one possibility here is that officers are making mistakes, and we're very concerned about that. There's another hypothesis, which is that officers are actually rational, but they're deliberately conservative. Now, what does this mean? This would mean that they set a high bar because they see the cost of false positives as being very high. So we want to test between these two hypotheses here for explaining the sort of poor predictive performance because, you know, understanding the whether it's mistakes or whether it's sort of rational conservatism is important for thinking about remedies, what you might do instead. So we construct a couple of tests, one of which you've already seen. So test number one, can you do better than a coin toss? And as we've seen, 10% of the officers do worse than random even after the censoring adjustment. And, you know, economic theory says that there's no rational cost-benefit calculation that can explain doing worse than chance. Okay, so at least 10% of the cops are making lots of mistakes. Now, more generally, there's a more general test, and this is about who gets classified as being at high risk. So economic theory here tells us that if officers were rational, then they would flag the highest risk cases first. So we built a model of the objective risk that's faced by victims and check whether officers prioritize accordingly. We find out that they don't, and in fact that many objectively low risk cases are classified as high risk. So based on both of these exercises, we conclude that officers' poor predictions can't be fully explained by rational conservatism. Instead, they are, at least in part, they're genuine mistakes. Now, having said all that, before it sounds like I'm here to disparage police officers, let me make really clear. With some more background, I think it's pretty understandable where these mistakes are, well, why officers are making mistakes. So there's a practitioner literature that tells us that officers receive limited training on the DASH instrument. That same literature tells us that they get almost no feedback on whether their predictions turn out to be right. So, and then without feedback, obviously, they can't learn from experience. So these mistakes are happening. Given this background, it's perhaps not too surprising that they're mistakes. Perhaps the magnitude of the mistakes is still surprising. It's certainly troubling. But it also raises the next question, which is, you know, what is driving officers' decisions? Okay, and so here, what we find, among other things, are cognitive biases in risk assessment. And in fact, when we look at the data, we identify three major sources of officers' errors. It turns out one is bad information. It turns out that the DASH questionnaire itself contains misleading items. Beyond that, we find two types of cognitive bias sort of heuristic decision making. One which is termed representativeness bias. And here we can think that officers overweight features that seem like they should predict danger. The other is called categorization selective attention. And what we find there is that a single salient feature can shift how officers basically interpret all the other evidence before them. So let's walk through those in turn. In terms of bad information, so as I said at the very beginning, so the DASH has 27 questions. And we don't have enough time for me to take you through the questionnaire, but take my word for it. All of these are worded as if an affirmative answer should indicate higher risk. There are no trick questions on the DASH, okay? Nevertheless, when we look at the data, we find that roughly half of these questions are counterpredictive. That means a positive answer is actually associated with a lower risk of serious recidivism. Now, because all the questions are worded as though a positive answer should predict greater risk, you know, officers naturally treat them as such, right? And so they treat all of the affirmative answers as danger signals. Okay, so the result is systematically distorted predictions. So that's an important source of error. Now, another source is representativeness bias. So the idea here is that when people lack training and feedback, they assess risk based on representative features. And in our case, a feature is representative of serious recidivism if it shows up more often among cases that end up in recidivism than among those that don't. Okay, now, so this there's a theory that tells us that representative features should lead to overprediction. And so this goes back to Kahneman and Tversky back in the 1970s, the work for which they eventually won a Nobel Prize. But it turns out, so there, a more recent contribution by Pedro Bardolo and his collaborators actually refined the prediction from that model in an important way. Because what they pointed out is that there's actually an interaction between the representativeness of predictive features and the prevalence of those features in the population. And so specifically what they find is that representative features should influence beliefs more when they are rare, but when a representative feature is common, it should influence beliefs much less. So that's the prediction. And what we find in the data is that officers respond exactly this way. So there are a number of rare and representative features that have large effects on risk classifications. There are two features that are representative but also common, and we find that they have a little effect. Okay, now one of those features is sort of an important finding in its own right. And this feature involves alcohol and drug problems. So one of the questions from the DASH asks the victim whether the perpetrator, the abuser, has had problems with alcohol, drugs, other substances during the past year. And it turns out that this question is a serious indicator of risk. So a positive response to that question raises the risk of serious recidivism by about 1.5 percentage points, or about 10% of the baseline. Alcohol and drug problems are representative. They occur more often among the recidivists than among the non-recidivists, but they're also common. The prevalence rate is about 37% in our sample. As a result, what we find is exactly consistent with the theory. We find that alcohol and drug problems don't move officers' beliefs. So despite the fact that these things predict risk, officers don't treat them as such. And so the consequence here is that victims whose abusers have substance problems are underprotected. So they have elevated risk, but they're not flagged for help. And this gives rise to false negatives. Okay, so that brings us to categorization and selective attention. And this may be one of the most striking things we found yet. The theory here comes once again from Pedro Bardolo and his remarkably productive team. It's a rather different model. And so in this model, you have a decision maker who faces potentially a number of predictive signals. So you can think of these as the DASH features. And the decision maker assigns a case to a mental category based on one salient feature. And the thing about that salient feature is that once categorized, the decision maker pays more attention to other features that are consistent with that category. So this model predicts two things. One is instability, which means there are large changes in beliefs from a single feature, and selective attention, which is their amplified attention to related features. So we want to test this model. What's interesting about this is this model potentially explains some important interactions that we observed in the data and otherwise had no explanation for. And so we wanted to figure out how to test this. And testing this requires that we take a stand on what is the salient feature? What is the feature that triggers the officer's categorization of cases into one category or another? And so what we did here is we basically took a cue from the behavioral economics literature on the one hand, the psychology literature that preceded it on the other. And both of those literatures stress the importance of similarity between the predictive features and the thing that the decision maker is trying to predict. Okay, so we wanted to find a feature in the dash, that one of the questions in the dash that seemed most similar to the serious recidivism or the serious harm that the officer was trying to predict. And so we took that feature, or potential trigger feature, as being the very first question on the dash. The very first question asks whether the victim was injured at the current incident. And the idea is that, at least in our mind, you can imagine that an officer shows up at the scene of the incident, sees that the victim is injured, and thinks in the back of her mind that the whole reason for the risk assessment is to prevent the very same thing from happening again. Okay. So that seems to satisfy criteria for similarity. Okay, so what do we find? We can first look at instability. Now, before we do that, actually, I just want to show relationship between victim injury on the one hand and actual recidivism rate, right? Actual risk. And so what we see here is that a victim injury at the current incident has a moderately large effect on actual recidivism risk. So in the absence of victim injury, recidivism risk is 12%. In the presence of an injury at the current incident, that rises to 17%. It's a fairly large change. However, it is dwarfed by the effect that a victim injury has on the officer's high-risk classification. So for cases where there are no victim injuries, officers classify 6.5% of those cases as high risk. In contrast, if there's a victim injury, over a quarter, 26.5% of those cases are classified as high risk. So a case that involves a victim injury is four times more likely to be classified as high risk than a case that doesn't. So this is precisely the kind of instability that is predicted by, the Bordello et al. Model. Okay, so the next thing we want to do is look at selective attention. And so the idea here is that once the officer sees that the victim is injured, or if the presence or absence of a victim injury is going to trigger a classification, a categorization of the case. And so we give a name to the category and basically say if the officer sees that the victim is injured, she sorts this into a category called dangerous abuser. And what happens then, we find that she pays much more attention to other features of the dash that suggest an intent to harm or victim vulnerability. And by far the biggest increase in attention involves the question in the dash that asks whether the perpetrator has ever threatened to kill the victim. Okay, so essentially raises the decision maker, raises the police officer's attention to these other features most strongly towards death threats. Now, one could argue that, well, death threats are also sort of similar to the outcome that the officer is trying to predict. Do death threats trigger selective attention as well? And so we did the same exercise, now letting the death threat be the trigger feature or the salient feature. And we find out that the pattern works in reverse. And specifically, when the officer learns of prior death threats, she pays much more heightened attention, much greater attention, to a victim injury, as well as some other violence-related features. So there seems to be something to this. It seems to be that when the officer sees a feature that triggers this dangerous abuser category, she becomes much more attentive to other features in the same category. Now, what does this mean? So what this does is, because officers tend to overreact to the dash features, what this means is this heightens overreaction, worsening their predictions even more than they would have been in the absence of the victim injury, for example. And so what this means in sort of thinking about what to, where to go next is it means that features don't just affect beliefs directly. They also change what other information the officer attends to. And this in turn means that a bad question on the dash can do double damage. Even if it's not directly misleading, it may redirect, redirect attention to questions that are. Okay, so this is sort of what we've been working on for the last 5 or 6 years. And so what have we learned? I think I can summarize by saying the first thing, one thing we've learned is that charges protect victims, but the risk assessment process does not. As I showed before, criminal charges reduce serious recidivism by about 5 percentage point, but we don't find any effect for the Dash-Merrick process. We find at least part of the explanation for that is that officers' predictions are lacking, even after accounting for censoring their predictions on average are barely better than chance. And we find that officers rely on heuristics and cognitive shortcuts. Perhaps not surprisingly, in the absence of training and feedback, they resort to specific mechanisms of representative bias categorization and selective attention. And the final thing we learned is that the instrument itself is part of the problem. To reiterate what I said before, roughly half of the DASH questions are counterpredictive and bad questions can amplify bias. Okay, so that sort of summarizes what we've learned. So I want to spend some time, last few minutes that I have here, talking about how we might take that information and do something useful with it. So I want to talk about three possible futures regarding risk assessment, sort of where do we go from here. And the three options that I want to talk about are, one, that we abandon risk assessment. It doesn't work very well, so why are we doing it? The second one is providing better instruments and better training. And then the third is adopting algorithmic recommendation systems. Okay, so I want to take those in turn. So abandoning risk assessment, is this a good idea? And I think the answer here is a very clear no. One of the potential advantages to a risk assessment system is that it provides a mechanism to provide protection to high-risk victims whose cases aren't prosecuted. Many cases are not prosecuted. Nevertheless, many of those cases are still at high risk. It's incredibly valuable to have a process in place to provide protective services. So I think a risk assessment process is way too valuable to give up on. So what do we think about next? What about better instruments and better training? One thing we could clearly do is redesign the questionnaire. We could remove the counterpredictive questions to start. The other thing we need to do in thinking about the replacements is we need to test questions as an ensemble, because we have to be attentive to this idea of selective attention, and that the answer to one question changes the attention that officers paid to another. And this is a departure from current practice. There's a very large literature on survey design where, you know, analysts stress the importance of testing questions before testing questions to make sure they work the way you expect before you actually take them to the field. And the thing is that's always on the basis of individual questions. And I think what we found is it's really important to think more broadly than that and think about testing questions as an ensemble. Oh, and then finally, what we need to do, what we could do that would really potentially improve the outcomes, is weight questions according to their actual predictive value, not just sort of face validity. Okay, so that's one thing we could do in terms of better instruments. So what about better training and feedback? Well, clearly we could provide better training based on the literature that's out there. We can also give officers feedback on the accuracy of their past predictions, because what we know is without feedback, they can't learn, and we've seen that heuristic decision making fills the gap. Okay, now, having said that, I want to ask another question, which is whether better training could ever be enough. And to do this, I want to contrast two groups of people who make important predictions. One group is radiologists, the other is police officers. Now, why radiologists? What do? Radiologists read diagnostic images, and based on what they see, they predict the presence of disease. Let's think about the training they get. They get 4 years of medical school, they get 4 years as a resident, and then they get 1 or 2 optional years as a fellow. Despite all of that training, 8 to 10 years of training, a recent study shows that in predicting pathology from chest x-rays, which is radiologists' bread and butter, 2/3 of them perform worse than predictive algorithms. Now let's talk about police officers. So training is variable. To give just a couple examples, in Chicago, Police recruits spend 6 weeks at the academy. The MET does a little better. Recruits spend 16 weeks in the classroom. But of course, during this period, training covers all aspects of policing, not just risk assessment. And so I think it's reasonable to ask the question whether we could ever provide enough training for police officers to perform even as well as radiologists, two-thirds of whom fare poorly compared to a predictive algorithm. Which brings me to predictive algorithms. So, or algorithmically assisted risk assessment. So there are pluses and minuses with algorithms. Perhaps one of their main advantages is that they don't suffer from cognitive biases. So they can learn which questions are generally predictive and which are misleading. Their attention to one question is not affected by responses to another. And by design, they weight information according to statistical evidence, not salience. So potentially, algorithmic recommendations could provide better predictions, meaning they would better identify victims who need protection and reduce the number who fall through the cracks. And I want to be really clear here, what I'm talking about here is not replacing officers, but rather giving them better tools to make consequential decisions. Now, I want to talk about downsides. And the big downside that many people focus on, and rightly so, is that algorithms will make mistakes. There's no denying that. At the same time, I don't think there's any denying that all systems will make mistakes, whether they involve algorithms or not. And there's no use saying otherwise. Mistakes will cause suffering. Each one will be tragic, whether it's made by a machine or a human being. So given that, I think our goal should be to put together a system that will make as few mistakes as possible. Okay, now you might be asking, okay, so are algorithms really that much better? Now I want to go back to one of the early slides where we were talking about DASH having a false negative rate of 89%. So what this means is the DASH identifies only 11% of victims who will suffer a serious repeat incident. So in contrast, recent work by my team shows that even simple algorithms can do four times better, identifying up to 44% of repeat victims. And given sort of the improvements in predictive technology that are happening on a monthly basis, it seems, I think we can make that number even bigger.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question. Like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Okay, so what do we know? Even simple algorithms do much better than DASH. I think there's a great potential for them to improve victim safety. And with that, I'm done. Here's a summary. Thanks for your attention.
Okay, great. Thanks, Jeff. Very good. Very, very good. Okay, so we can move to a Q&A session now. We can have questions here in the room, or perhaps online, which are going to appear on the iPad, if there are any, I think. To the online audience out there, if you want to ask any questions, then put them into whatever you put them into, computer, the algorithm. we've got a roving mic, I think, around here, so maybe we can take a couple of questions from the audience to start with, and then Jeff can respond, maybe we'll go online and we'll alternate in between. So who's got the hand? I think that hand maybe was up back fast, I think, but we can go around as well.
Thanks very much.
Can you just say who you are as
yeah,
well?
Yeah, I was going to
and
say.
And your affiliation, if you have one.
So well. My name's Diana Barron, and I was the founder of Safe Lives, and we were part of the team that developed the DASH risk assessment. And actually, I was personally very involved in building it. So I've got a million questions, which I'm not going to bore the audience with. But I was just honestly quite troubled by some of the conclusions that you drew and some of the context that did not come out. So I just think it's helpful for the audience, and I invite you to respond, obviously. So the DASH tool was developed because police forces around the country were all using different risk tools, and there was no common risk tool that could be used by the voluntary sector supporting women, by health, by children's services, by a whole range of agencies. And the reality, which you will obviously understand very well, is that women, particularly in a crisis when they've just called the police, may not choose to tell the police everything, but we need a common language of risk which every agency can use. So the midwife can use the same as the police officer and may well get very different information. And it was never designed as a risk assessment tool. It was designed as I agree it's pedantic and maybe sounds like splitting hairs, but there were long debates, as you can imagine. It was designed as a risk identification checklist. So it was just, have we got enough information, which allows us to share information legally without a woman's consent across agencies to try and put together a safety plan. And I think that inevitably implementation is patchy for all sorts of reasons, but I think it is important to understand that context. I'm riveted to know which of the questions that are misleading, because every question on the list comes from a domestic homicide review. So, you know, clearly there is always room for improvement. And the only other thing I would say at this point is, well, two things briefly, if I may. One is, in terms of recidivism, I think using what look like criminal justice type criteria in terms of serious violence and sexual offences is, you know, of course the police are going to be looking for things that they can charge and get a conviction. But when you talk to women about their experience, the thing they will talk most about is the coercion, the control, the loss of freedom in their lives. If you're a police officer, you might be sympathetic, but you know you can't get a conviction. So that, and then the last thing I would say, and I would say this was particularly true in GMP, who we worked with a lot, was there was just a whole lot of gatekeeping that went on. So police officers would be told, you cannot have more than X percent high-risk victims. So that was a massive distortion in what came out. I don't want to, you know, I recognize, really, I underline, there is huge progress to be made, and there's a million things in terms of implementation that need to be done better, and I think your research is helpful in pointing to some of those, but I just wanted to give some context, because we live in a super imperfect world when it comes to dealing with this issue, and I just don't want the audience, who may be a bit less close to it, to walk away thinking we just need to tear this stuff up. Because if you look at any risk tool, whether it's Jackie Campbell's danger assessment tool or any of the others, they're broadly the same questions. You know, there are a few differences around the edges, but they're broadly the same questions. But thank you. I just felt it was important to say that.
Right, thanks. Let's take a second one, and some member move to it. I think there's you had, yeah. Okay. Down here, then.
Okay. Hi, my name is Asifa, and I work with Asian Women's Resource Center, so we support Black and minoritized victim survivors. Take on board everything which was said, Diana, around safe lives risk assessment. We did a recent paper about this from a perspective of how it impacts Black and minoritized women. And clearly, it does need restructuring. The risk assessment tools have been made a long time ago for a specific victim survivor in mind. Surely not, you can't have it's not a be all and end all risk assessment. A lot goes in the background in terms of laws have changed, particularly coercive controlling behavior, things like harmful practices, honor based abuse, and forced marriage, which are not always captured in the risk assessment tool. And particularly, we know that Black and marginalized women, they are assessed quite low on risk assessment, but they are disproportionately impacted by homicides as well. So from our perspective, we really feel that it needs restructuring. So, and from police perspective as well, it's used as a checklist as well, rather than meaningfully do it. And one of the important finding which came out from in collaboration with other organizations, domestic abuse organizations, was that a rapport needs to be built in first before the risk assessment is done. You might have the best risk assessment in the world, but and you training is not enough, but it's about understanding those communities. We know that there's a huge issue of racism in police itself. Yesterday there was another event organized by LSE where two black women were murdered by the same perpetrator, but nothing was done. Even those cases might have gone to Marux as well. So there's a lot of things. I know you looked at it from one perspective, of course, but it just needs lots of changes. So we'd love to collaborate with you in terms of future work. But also, please do get in touch with domestic abuse organizations when you're doing such work. It just helps. But I know you looked at it from the police perspective, so there's lots to talk about, but I just wanted to flag these things. Thank you.
Yeah, so thank you. I'd like to respond. So I'm afraid I'm only going to be able to offer a partial response because those were long questions. But one thing as you were saying, basically any system can be improved upon. I think that there are things that we would do different too today. So for example, as I mentioned, our data from the period 2014 to 2019, that has to do with an audit. GMP changed their computer system, nothing's backward compatible, that's what we have. But one of the reasons that's important is because coercive control by itself was not even a law on the books until 2015. And when you sort of look at national reports, you see that there weren't many charges involving coercive control until right around 2019 or so. That's changed. About 25% of cases, domestic abuse cases that are charged now involve coercive control. So that's one of the things that we would add to the outcome. That's the way we would change the outcome today, precisely to capture that concern. That might not capture it completely, but it would give sort of voice to that part of the domestic abuse experience and something that you would want to take account of and predict. I guess the other thing I want to say is so I've read some of the history. Obviously, I don't have the grasp on the history of someone who was there at the time. But what I have read is that the dash was at one point intended for a different purpose, at another point intended for multiple purposes. I think it's fair to say that it has morphed into a risk assessment protocol, and so that's why I think it's important to respond to its use as a risk assessment protocol, pointing out that on that ground it doesn't really perform very well, and I think there are a lot of directions we could go with improvement.
Is that an answer to both? Or
yeah, that's sort of. I think we're seeing the limits of my memory of the number of questions. Maybe we do it every speaker, every question is done.
Okay, we've got an online one. Let's alternate and go online next. So is it possible that the reason police officers misinterpret the dash form is based on gender bias?
So we can't rule that out. What we can do is we can and have do split the sample according to the gender of the police officer who's responding. About 25% of the police officers during this period at GMP were women, and their predictions are indistinguishable from those of their male counterparts. So that doesn't jump out as an explanation.
Okay. I've got your hand up this time now.
Hi, my name's Solvay, and I'm an alumni, and I'm also a domestic abuse caseworker. So I'm echoing what both of you said. I was just curious to know whether you, because you were saying how you were able to research and study the attitudes or the way police officers conducted themselves when asking these questions, but I'm just curious to know whether you also researched how these women or any gender were acting during these questions are asked, because they're horrendous questions. They can be very triggering, and I think a big thing that, I mean, police officers can really get training on being trauma-informed. That's like the really just the baseline. And, I had another question. That was kind of it. I was just wondering whether you also just studied how women were acting during those questions, because 27 questions is really long. But I like all of them. Anyways.
Okay. Yeah, so the unfortunate answer to that question is no. So we don't have any information about the nature of the interaction between the particular officer and the victim. We don't have, there apparently were some free text fields. Those are long gone. So as much as that would be something we would like to incorporate, we won't. One thing I will say is that, so you mentioned that the questions can be very triggering. The questions feel like they're pretty intrusive, many of them, and they're asked at a particularly fraught moment. So you can see all sorts of ways that interaction can go wrong. One thing that we've learned is with a couple of the studies so far is, in terms of just pure risk prediction, we can do better with just information in the GMP database than we can with the dash. And in fact, when we add the dash to that other information in the database, it doesn't really improve the predictions. And so what this means is potentially a risk assessment system where you don't have to trigger the victim with a bunch of questions which may be triggering and which aren't predictive to get a better prediction.
Sorry, I'm Anya. I am currently a trainee solicitor. I work on inquests, so a lot of domestic homicides, but I also used to be a IDVA. Basically, I was just wondering what data would you be relying on from the GMP database that would be more predictive, that doesn't involve asking the victim? I mean, just immediately that springs to mind that you would only be relying on criminal histories, maybe, but maybe that assumption's wrong. Yeah, that was my question.
So their criminal histories, their domestic abuse histories, those turn out to be quite predictive. And this isn't novel to us. So other people who have been devising predictive models have found the same thing, that the recency of incidents and recency interacted with severity are really powerful predictors of what happens over the next 6 to 12 months. Those are doing a lot of the work, and they don't, again, the dash doesn't really seem to contribute once you account for those things.
I think it was one too long.
Hi, I'm Amelia. I'm on the Gender Policy and Inequalities program here. I just had a question on your conclusions about using AI processes. When AI is being proven kind of consistently now to have gender bias and racial bias built into the data sets it's being given, how would you suggest kind of making sure those aren't playing into a situation which is clearly gender-based at the core?
Okay, can I add one of my questions, which is related to this as well? So the thing that, one of the really striking empirical things that you put up there, so when we look at misclassification in many settings, we look at the 2x2 matrix, and we often look at the off diagonals, and they often end up being relatively symmetric. This is just so striking, that the difference between the false positives and the false negatives. And you have the stuff about the police officers perhaps being conservative and so on as well. Yeah. But it's an enormous gap between the two. So I thought that was really interesting. I mean, it speaks a little bit perhaps to this question as well. And additionally, so I wondered, so you're focusing on the one where there's a huge amount of misclassification. How does the algorithm do in predicting the other side of the false positives?
Okay, so I'm going to answer this question because it's fresh in my mind, and I'm going to come back to yours.
It's very related, though.
So I think there's a couple answers. One is there's a mechanical bit that when you have a 9% prediction rate, your errors are going to be dominated by false negatives just because you have so many negative predictions. The other thing is, if you think about the false positives versus the false negatives, the
let's say the social costs of these things are very asymmetric. So the cost of a false positive is, now, and this is really important here because there are no criminal justice consequences associated with the risk rate or the protective services. It's just all about protective services. So the false positive means that you provide protective services to a victim who may be at less risk than another victim. Right? On the other hand, what a false negative means is that you don't provide services to a victim who evidently needs it. Right? And so the social costs of false negatives are much higher than false positives, so you really care about those. And you care about improving, reducing the false negatives. Now, if you could ask me your question again. I apologize, but I find dual tasking here.
It was partly systematic bias built into the AI.
Oh, the systematic bias. So I think there's an answer here. It's very counterintuitive, but stay with me. The fact is, in our sample, 80% of the victims are women, so 20% are men. And there's reason to think that among those 20%, many of those are basically false counterclaims, which means more than 80% of the victims are women. If you train an algorithm on women, you're just looking at women. So the opportunity for gender bias is not nearly as great. You're not comparing the two genders in the way that you are with in many other things. So there are basically sort of checkpoints, mileposts, things that you want to look at. There are sort of technical evaluation criteria that you apply to these things that work in some cases well, in some cases less well. But I think that the gender bias issue in these cases is less than would initially appear, simply because the vast majority of your training base is women.
Okay, have we got any more? No more online questions? No. Maybe finishing a little early? No, it's fine.
I think there's a lot to talk about risk assessment because you're looking at from the lens of police, and it's very statistical as well in terms of like if the person who's risk assessing is not trauma informed, should they be even doing risk assessment? You know, that's the main thing because it's not always about predicting it and all that. So there's a lot to talk about. One can talk a lot. So, as well as sexual abuse and sexual violence, there's the language of risk assessment, the way it's structured. The first question is, has the current incident resulted in injury? So again, it's a lot of focus on physical injury. And we don't, when we work frontline, we don't, this is not how we do the risk assessment, but police might as well, because we have to build that rapport. And it takes a while and time and energy as well as that specialism to do that. One-off training would not help it. If you see the way police do the risk assessment, unfortunately, some of them do it very well, but most of them, again, it's a tick box exercise as well. They will assess perpetrators and victims as well. So there's lots to take from all that. But I know you did research from a different angle. It doesn't also have that ethnicity, faith, and gender lens from this finding as well. So I would like to know more, if I'm really honest, in terms of, I felt it was very generic, but we can use this research. Of course, I'm not saying it's useful, but also people in your team, are they much aware about it, the dynamics of domestic abuse, and so that there could be, I would have expected more, if I'm really honest. Thank you.
So I guess what I would say is the part of your point gets to this question, could we ever provide enough training? And particularly, could we ever provide enough training to first responders? And if you think that that would be fundamentally difficult, then that might suggest that we leave the first response risk assessment to something that's trained on a lot of data instead of an individual that we don't train very much, and then leave specialist assessments to specialists who have that training. So I'm not optimistic about the idea of training police to be effective social workers. I think an alternative here would provide a better risk assessment.
I definitely take on board that, but there are lots of multiple factors which play in as well when one is assessing the risk, right? And in terms of how much victim survivor feels comfortable talking about things, that's really crucial and critical, particularly in domestic abuse and sexual violence as well. But I get it, like we always come, lots of report really important talk about training, but also looking at the tool itself. I mean, how effective is the tool? Do we need to think about it from more intersectional lens as well? Disability, LGBT, and black and white, those things are critical as well in terms of that. So thank you.
Okay, but so we've got a question online that speaks to some of the things you're saying, actually. A longish one, and we've got a very short one. I'll go with a short one first, and then I'll come back to the second one. And so Jamie Hobday says, one sentence question, are GMP going to be taking any action on your findings? Except the slightly longer question is from Subha Mukherjee, who's a DA practitioner in the UK, who says, I'm concerned we're looking at risk scores and recidivism, but missing a big missing piece of interventions with the victim as well as perpetrator in the aftermath of the incident, which is delivered by specialist services who were not consulted. So there's various variables in between that could be productive. I think it's asking a bit of a question about mediating factors. So a little bit is speaking to the question over here, I think, as well. And saying, so they're sort of overemphasizing the possibly predictive nature of the dash. Saying other things that haven't post. In between the dash assessment and then the subsequent recidivism.
Right. So I guess there's a number of ways to take this. I view this through the lens of, can you improve predictions? So one possibility is if better questions that you could add to the information we use. I would be in favor of that. I guess I also see there's one question, which is, what is the victim's risk level? And then there's a question of what services would best suit her interests. And I'm not optimistic that we're going to train a model to answer that latter question. And so I think we can predict risk levels. I think we can get to that point. But there's this whole other question about, well, what do you do then? So you believe that the victim is at risk. What should you do? That's not a one-size-fits-all exercise. That's something that's handled by specialists. And like one of the things that I hear from police is they're concerned about the capacity of the MERIC, for example. So that might suggest devoting more resources in that second step. What is it that's in the benefit? What is it that's in the interest of the victim? Once you believe they're at high risk. I'm not sure you need to combine the risk assessment exercise as well as the service evaluation exercise.
Which is an outcome as well, of course.
I'm sorry?
It's an outcome as well, of course. Mm-hmm. Service, a specialist service.
Yeah. Sure.
Are GMP going to be taking the action on your findings?
Oh, that's under discussion.
Okay. Short answer to a short question.
Yeah.
have we got any more? Or have we? Oh yeah, we got one here.
Yeah, thank you for the. That was really interesting insights and also the discussions from people who are more on the front line. I'm later, I'm an economics student, so I don't have a lot of that nuance. One of the questions I had was, obviously you're looking at a police database and kind of judging recidivism off kind of charges and police data. Do you think the findings would have been different if you'd had access to some of the data from the protective services? And do you have any ideas of what you think you might have seen if you'd been able to see kind of the victims' referrals and how those had gone?
Yeah, I can only speculate about that. So in an ideal world, I would like to see more than just the police-based outcomes. NHS, for example.
Sorry, yeah, I've got a question as well. I'm Anisha, I'm a child protection social worker. I guess what I'm really curious about is when you're speaking around kind of an algorithm, I guess, is there like an idea, and you may already have spoken to this, about kind of what data might be going in to kind of train the algorithm, what kind of data would be expected for officers to put in for, I guess, the like a number to be generated? Because I understand kind of with probation, other services that use this kind of predictive model, there is like lots of different data that's kind of relevant to the victim, the perpetrator, like related to like age, gender, faith. And I guess I'm thinking kind of from my experiences in child protection social work about actually like the risk sometimes of like flattening, and like actually like what one person's understanding of their faith is and how that's practiced is going to be different to another's, how that shapes therefore their life and their life's experiences. So I'd be curious to understand a bit more about like what data you would kind of expect to go into algorithm, what to be trained on, and I guess how some of that flattening of kind of people's individual identities might be accounted for when thinking about like in risk assessment as well.
Yeah, so at this point we're limited to police data, which has its limitations, and that's both for constructing outcomes as well as for constructing the predictors. I'll say two things. One is, I would love to have more inclusive data, both to construct the outcomes as well as to construct predictors. Having said that, getting different agencies to talk to each other, work with each other, make accommodations with outside researchers, that's a tough one. So I think there could be big improvements there. It's gonna take some work.
Okay, we've got a follow-up question from Suba Mukherjee again. Is there a bigger question here that we need to break from what patriarchal first response needs to break away from? And therefore be really be curious about how criminal justice systems can be redesigned for women to serve them better and be tailored to experiences of crime and also associated trauma. And then the iteration. It's not about police being social workers, but about principles of first response responding better to women's needs.
Which is
a big question.
This is a very big question. It's well beyond the domain of risk assessment. Far be it for me to say and to answer that question negatively. I guess you want to make those steps where you can. And it seems like the relatively small step of improving risk assessment, potentially improving sort of targeting services towards victims at higher risk, improving the services, maybe providing more resources for specialist workers, better tailored services to be more protective. That seems like something that is potentially feasible to me. Bigger questions about making police more responsive to women, to other groups in society, are huge questions, and those are going to take different inputs.
Okay, and then a second question from Jamie Hopter as well. Second question, has any of this work been published yet? Some of it's been published.
Yeah.
So
some of it's published, some it's not yet.
Jamie, you should contact Jeff.
Yeah, but it's all written up. It's all written up. Some is published, some is not, but yes, I'm happy to share it.
Do we have anything else from the audience, or indeed the online audience? Lots of questions. We've had already, so that's good. No? Last chance saloon? No? Okay, great. Well, I think we should just thank Jeff and indeed the Q&A from the audience and online. It was a very good event.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.